telephone interview with Alana Peters, November 7th, 2005, by Kenneth Durr.
I do want to start with some background and talk a little bit about your education. I know that you went to USC Law School.
Yes, I did. I graduated in 1973.
And how about...
And USC Law School is the University of Southern California.
You're right. The Law Center.
Somewhere on Google, they say it's the University of South Carolina.
I guess they're trying to make a claim for that, huh?
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I keep meaning to write them about all the things they have wrong.
What
I've got better things to do with my time.
What about undergrad?
I went to the College of New Rochelle. It's located in New Rochelle, New York.
Sure.
It's a Catholic women's college.
Oh, I see.
Liberal arts school. And now it is almost a university, actually. It issues BA degrees, and it has a school of nursing, and it has a master's program as well.
Is there something you studied at New Rochelle that led you toward law?
No. No. Do you want to know what I majored in at New Rochelle?
Sure.
I was a philosophy major.
I see.
I majored in philosophy, and I had enough units in science to have a minor in science.
Okay. What led you to sort of parlay philosophy and science into a legal career?
Well, I don't know that I actually parlayed my educational background into a legal career. What led me to law school was the desire to pursue a graduate degree so that I could pursue a career outside of the home.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I decided that I had approaching a time in my life when I was going to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
This was about 7 years after I'd finished college.
Oh, okay.
I did some traveling in the interim.
I see.
I was discussing the matter with my husband and tossing around ideas about what I might do and what I might study to so that I could parlay it into a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking education. He was thinking something else, and he suggested law. And I said, well, gee, that's an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
He encouraged me to do it. He thought that I would be good at it. And so I enrolled in law school and we returned to the United States. We were living overseas at the time.
Oh, I see. So you came in, were you behind other students in your class as far as age coming in?
I think the way I would put it is ahead of them.
Yeah.
Yes, I definitely was. Most
yeah.
of the students in my class at SC were 7 to 8 years my junior.
Right out of undergrad.
They were, yes, most of them. There were a number of, there were some who, like me, had pursued other interests before going into law school, but we were a minority. I hesitate to guess, but I would think that there were certainly no more than, you know, there were fewer than 10%
mm-hmm.
of the folks that were matriculating at University of Southern California Law School at the time
right.
that had been often doing other things. But there certainly were some.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the process like landing a job? I know that it's very competitive.
Oh, yes. I'm not sure I understand the question. It's pretty...
Did you go right into Gibson Dunn after law
Oh,
school?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I did. I had not originally planned on a career in corporate law. When I entered law school, I thought that what I would do would be join the legal aid service after graduation.
Mm-hmm.
So I, but I had a number of friends who were committed to that avenue as a career, that career path. And after volunteering my time working for a legal aid office after my second year, and comparing that with the opportunity that I had to clerk at a law firm after my first year, mm-hmm. I decided that perhaps the best path for me would be to join a law firm and satisfy my need to give to the local community by doing pro bono work. Mm-hmm. And at the time, in the early 70s, it was quite not only acceptable but encouraged by the law firms for new lawyers to give some part of their time to pro bono work. And so I, at my third year, I started interviewing the law firms here in Los Angeles. Of course, I was married and settled
right.
With a home here in Los Angeles, so there wasn't a question of going outside of this geographical area for a job. And I interviewed a number of firms. I received a number of offers, and I selected Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher.
What made you choose them?
Well, Gibson, Dunn was one of the three largest law firms in the state at that time. One of the two largest in Los Angeles. There was O'Melveny & Myers and Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. And if they offered, because of its size and the breadth of its client base, they offered a very wide range of legal experience. And I wanted the environment of a large firm. I had a life outside of my career, and I just thought it was going to be easier to have both, pursue a wonderful law career and still have some distance from the office, the larger the firm, sort of the bigger the pond to swim in.
Uh-huh.
And also I thought that a larger firm would assure me that at the time, 100 and so, I think there were 150 lawyers at Gibson Dunn. We eventually grew to be the fifth largest or sixth largest in the nation. At 700 lawyers, I think, but we're back down in size now, not to 150. I don't really know how many lawyers they have, but you could find that out if
you're
interested.
Right.
That's a pretty big pond to play in, and I felt that I would have enough of an opportunity to find people that I would enjoy working with and that would enjoy working with me when there was a pool of 150 lawyers as opposed to 20.
Right.
Or 30 lawyers. And that I would also find people with similar taste and similar interests to make out up a pretty, as broad as I cared to have, social life with my fellow colleagues, my colleagues at Gibson Dunn. And that, in fact, proved to be the case. I don't know that had I accepted one of the offers that I had at smaller firms than the 30 to, I didn't interview any firms that were smaller than 30.
Yeah.
30 to 50 range. They were all wonderful firms, top-notch firms, and I'm sure I would have had a great experience there, too. But that was my thinking at the time.
That's interesting. A lot of folks would sort of choose the opposite, the big fish in the small pond.
The big fish in the small pond.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess, I never have been that much of a conformist.
Was it corporate law that you were involved in from the beginning? Other than the pro bono side?
Yes, to the extent. I mean, I'm interpreting your question to focus on, were your clients corporations?
Yes.
So yes, to that extent, mm-hmm. Right from the beginning. But I was a litigator.
Okay.
A trial lawyer.
Right.
I was not
a
business lawyer, in that sense, if you're using the sense
yeah.
corporate lawyer.
Right.
As a business advisor, counsel, that was not me. I was a trial lawyer.
Mm-hmm. What kind of cases did you work on? What
I immediately, I was very much interested in doing litigation, and so immediately focused on that, although Gibson Dunn had a rotation program where for the first 2 years you had research assignments and assignments from partners and associates, senior associates, in their four primary departments, litigation, corporate, tax, probate, and labor. They had a really big labor practice. Mm. I was really immediately focused on litigation, and I let everyone know that that's what I wanted to do. I did do the odd assignment for research assignment for lawyers in other departments, but nothing really diverted my attention away from litigation. As a consequence of being willing to accept all kinds of assignments, and I think, in retrospect, and even at the time, developed fairly rapidly to have experience in handling motions and the like in court, making court appearances. And by the second year, I was assisting an associate older than me. I mean, not older than me, actually. He wasn't older than I, but he was senior by
right.
about 5 or 6 years in a trial. So by the time I was coming to the end of my second year at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, I had some trial experience under my belt.
Hmm.
That particular case, that very first case, was Ford Insurance Company, Aetna, I recall, and it involved defending Goodyear Tire. Goodyear Tire, who had been sued as a result of a street accident caused by a young man who had racing tires on his car, and the racing tires had been manufactured by Goodyear. Goodyear was insured by Aetna. It was a very interesting case, and I recall that the lead counsel, or first chair, as we say, was Tony Sinclitico, who was still a friend of mine, also retired from Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and I was his second chair.
Huh.
So I was off to the races after that. By the time I was a fifth-year associate, I had tried a case on my own, and my experience had broadened from personal injury tort experience to securities litigation. Actually, I think that my first or second year, I got involved in a major securities law class action involving equity funding,
mm-hmm.
Securities fraud, and I was representing an insurance company then, too, Pennsylvania Life Company, and an accounting firm, and that may have been Pete Marwick. I can't remember now I'm pretty sure it was Pete Marwick that had been sued as a result of that.
Yeah, I've actually seen a reference to that case as being a relatively important
landmark case. It didn't go to trial, but a lot of law and motion decisions that established quite a bit of precedent in the in the areas of securities fraud litigation.
Oh.
And for the rest of my career, I usually always had some securities case in hand, and securities fraud case, and also developed a specialty or expertise in representing accounting firms. And so I branched from securities litigation, securities fraud litigation, to accountant liability work as well. The other and then I would try anything actually. So more of a generalist than maybe most of people in large law firms tend to be.
But it does sound like you sort of drifted into the securities and accounting.
That was the securities and accounting were the mainstay. Yes, that's where my big cases were.
One of the interesting questions would be your progress as far as making partner, as far as advancing in the firm. You know, there are a number of things. You're being a woman, you're being an African-American, of course, in a mostly white male profession. And on top of that, there's the idea of coming into the profession a little bit late. I'm wondering if any of those things presented barriers that you had to deal with.
I can answer the answer about progress. As a firm in this way, at the time that I joined Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, they would hire anywhere from 12 to 15 people a year.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time in the early 70s, I think it was anticipated that maybe 85 to 90%, which would mean maybe all but one or two, would eventually make partner.
Oh, that's pretty good.
If they stayed that long.
Mm-hmm.
And at least that's as I came in, that's what I perceive the history of the firm to be. I did notice, however, that when I joined the firm after graduation, after having interviewed 6 or 7 months before, as a third year student, that I had interviewed a couple of African Americans that were there at the firm. They were no longer there by the time I got there, and about half of the women that had been there were no longer there. So that was an indication, I suppose, of something.
Uh-huh.
But frankly, I didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about it or worrying about it at that time. And this is where I think being older was certainly a help rather than a hindrance. There perhaps was an age beyond which it may be difficult to see yourself making partner at Gibson Dunn, and that would be preclusive almost of them saying, all right, I'm going to invest the time in this 50-year-old, male or female. They might hesitate to do that, okay,
mm-hmm.
because it's going to today it takes 8 to 9 years, maybe 10 years. Nobody makes it lockstep anymore today,
right.
For you to make partner. And at the time I joined Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, I was 31. And that's not too old.
Right.
It meant that I was 7 years to 8 years older than others, but certainly assuming that I had what it took to make partner, and at that time people were being considered for partner after being there for 7.5 years, 7.5 because you start in June,
mm-hmm.
and they consider you for partner in November.
I see.
And November, December is the process, and then they elect you to the partnership in December, effective the following January.
Okay.
So I joined the firm knowing that it was expected that you build this kind of hours, that you make have a perform in such a at such a level.
Right.
And that if you're good and they perceive that you are good and the clients like you, it does help to have the clients call and ask you to be their representative after being assigned to them.
Sure, bring in business.
Yeah. Well, or keep it at least for the first couple of years. the expectation when I joined Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher was that you would make partner at 7.5 years. In other words, after being there 7.5 years, by that November or so, you'd be elected to the partnership.
Mm-hmm.
There were 17 people in my class, and by the time we were up for partner, maybe 3 or 4 of those people had left to pursue other career paths, and I think two people right now who were not elected to the partnership. One left after that, and the other stayed and was elected the next year. I was one of the 12 people who was elected, as they say, on time, at 7.5 years. So I suppose it would be, I can't say that I definitely think that my age helped me deal with the pressures better than maybe being in your 20s, to be in your late 20s as opposed to your early 20s or your early 30s,
right,
instead of your mid-20s. But I couldn't say that being female or being I couldn't prove by my progress that being female or being black was a barrier.
Right.
I certainly was raised to anticipate people not always being 100% in my corner because of those things.
Right.
And I certainly worked hard to be sure that my performance left no doubt in anyone's mind that I was highly qualified, maybe even super qualified, to be a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. But I didn't have to suffer the disappointment, which is a nice way to look back on my career.
Yeah.
And I made it when my other colleagues made it.
Well, and it couldn't have been too much longer, I guess, before, you know, your qualifications brought you to the attention of the administration.
Well, exactly.
And
it was about 4 years later. I've been a partner. I made partner in 1970, and I was elected to the partnership in 79, effective January 1st, 1980.
Okay.
So I was a partner for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
When I got the call, it was which was a thrill. Actually, that was a thrill. But when a senior partner came into my office and said how pleased and proud he was to have me as his partner, that was a real thrill. I have to say that.
So the call from SEC was
the call from the administration came from somebody in the White House, the Reagan White House.
Uh-huh.
And I've heard a story that's hearsay as to how the people that were looking for sub-cabinet level appointees to the SEC got my name. I'll put that aside, but I don't know for sure.
Well, let's hear it with the caveat that it's hearsay.
Well, it is definitely hearsay. I was told by the then chairman of the SEC, John Shadd, who I ultimately served under at the SEC, that my name was surfaced by a prominent a businessman in San Francisco who was a Democrat, but prominent rich businessman, I suppose, that John Shadd had met at a gathering in San Francisco. And as I understand it, it was the Bohemian Club. You know, that ultra enclave of...
Right.
Right.
Okay. I've heard the stories.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so this is when I first met Shadd. And he took one look at me and he said, oh, you're Alana Peters. He said, well, he was talking to someone about the fact that there were two vacancies on the SEC and they needed a Democrat, two Democrats.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't know where to start looking for any, quote, good, unquote, Democrats. And this gentleman said, well, I wouldn't mind helping you out on that. I'm a Democrat, and let me see what I can do to surface some names of qualified people. According to Mr. Shadd, this gentleman sent him three names,
uh-huh.
and mine was on the list.
Huh.
And so I got a call saying, you know, or would you be interested in this appointment if it were offered to you? And by then I had learned to say yes, because I had gotten a similar call under the Carter administration and said, I'll think about it. And, of course, that opportunity was dissolved immediately. But I did say, yes, I would be interested, and it would have been a fabulous. I mean, I thought it was a fabulous opportunity for a lawyer. And I think I'm the only trial lawyer that's ever been an SEC commissioner.
That could be.
And when I got the call, I talked to my husband, and who said that he would certainly move to Washington with me if I got the job. In his heart of hearts, he didn't think I would ever get the job, but he promised that he would go. He confessed that to me later. and then I called Ted Olson, who had been a good friend and supporter, and I have to say, I mean, I don't like the word mentor because people never understand, I think, the same thing when you use the mm-hmm. word mentor, but I do consider that Ted Olson, who has just stepped down as the Solicitor General,
mm-hmm.
was a mentor in the best sense of the word. And I called him. At the time, he was an assistant attorney general, one of the four attorney generals under William Fred Smith, who was the attorney general at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that I'd gotten the call, and he was just delighted. He was in Washington serving the Reagan administration at the Justice Department. And he, again, offered me good advice. He said, have you talked to Dan Frost, who was at the time the chairman of our firm, the managing partner? I said, no, I've talked to Bruce and I've talked to you and my mother. And he said, you go talk to Dan first thing tomorrow morning. And he said, and call Bill, who was the Attorney General William French Smith, to you and me.
Sure.
And I talked to Dan Frost, and Dan Frost was delighted to have one of his partners called, and he got on the phone and spent the next 2 hours calling people all over the United States, in New York and Washington, trying to figure out what I needed to do or know to help this happen. And I mean, he really put a lot of time and energy into it. Such that he was setting up introductions to me for the who was the head of Citicorp at the time, John Reed, the head of the Blackstone yeah. Group. I mean, he was introducing me to lots of high-powered people who, if they would agree to be a reference or put in a good word, could have an impact. And I called the Attorney General, William French Smith, and told him about it. He acted and sounded thrilled, and I asked him if I could put him down as a reference, and he said, absolutely. So probably there's no better Democrat from the Republican administration's point of view that comes with the sitting Attorney General as a reference.
Right. It'd be hard to imagine one.
Right.
And so, he'd been associated with Gibson
He was
Dunn.
A partner at Gibson yeah. Dunn when I was there.
Okay.
Right. Or I was a partner while he was there.
Right.
Yes. So he did know me.
Now, you didn't
Although we had never worked together.
As I recall, you didn't have to wait too long before you
No, it was wonderful. I received the call in December and in early December, I suppose, and I was called to Washington within a couple of weeks for White House interviews. And I remember I had to fly into Washington. It was right around Christmas time. My husband and I had planned to spend Christmas with very good friends in England. And I he left and went on ahead, and I got snowbound in Washington, D.C., and sort of had to fight my way onto a plane after my day and a half or so of interviews. And I think it was probably I can't recall now, but it wasn't more than a month or so, a couple of months, that I was, I got the call saying, you're it?
Yeah.
You're it? I asked them, I was cheeky enough to ask that they, there was a 1-year term and a 4-year term, a 5-year term available, and I asked for the 5-year term. Just because I had to move from California, my husband was quitting his job to come with me, and I definitely, and I also wanted it to the extent that I could, to have a term where I wasn't looking over my shoulder and trying to figure out what to do to get reappointed.
Right.
There's nothing so freeing as knowing that you have several years to learn the job and maybe make a contribution. Without worrying about offending anyone.
Well, what did you find when you got there and sat down?
I found the SEC was a wonderful place to work. I enjoyed my colleagues. I probably was a little bit of a thorn in John Shad's side, but I think that we had a good personal relationship. Got along, at least from my perspective, but I was extraordinary. Probably from his perspective, I was extremely independent, and that caused him some grief at times. But I found a fairly collegial group at the commission. I mean, I'm meaning the commissioners. Mm-hmm. I got to be very good friends with everybody that served. Lindy Marinaccio was there only for a year.
Right.
Then he was replaced by Joe Grunfest, and we got to be good buddies as well. Charles Cox and Jim Treadway is to this day a dear, dear friend of mine. So it was a wonderful learning experience and a terrific all-around personal experience. The staff were extraordinarily generous with their time and their thought and their ideas. They were incredibly attentive to detail, to a person, extremely bright, dedicated. I just thought I've landed in government heaven, if there is such a thing.
Huh.
The SEC is, I'm very proud to have been a part of of the Securities and Exchange Commission as an independent agency. I found a lot of paperwork and tons of material to read. I had not anticipated that that there would be a public speaking aspect to the job, but interestingly enough, John Shadd, as chairman, did not enjoy public speaking and avoided it. And he asked me to speak to the Harvard Alumni Club within the first few months of my joining the commission on insider trading, which was Shad's big issue.
Right.
And I did. He attended that speech. I gave the speech on insider trading. And thereafter, it was interesting, whenever he was invited to speak to some group in Paris or Canada or something, I think he would parcel it out, but I seem to get more than my fair share of his speaking engagements.
Well, it's all about delegation, I guess.
It is all about delegation. So.
Well, you said it was intriguing. You said that John Shadd might have found you extremely independent. And
yeah,
I guess I'm wondering what you might have...
A bit of a thorn in his side, yeah.
I'm wondering what the issues...
Well, John had a very regulatory bent. Let me put that down. That's not quite it. He had a very anti-regulatory bent,
yeah.
Actually. I totally misspoke. Deeply attached to his Republican roots and to his roots as a businessman. He was vice chairman of E.F. Hutton, you recall.
Right.
And while I was fairly neutral, notwithstanding the fact that I am a Democrat, fairly neutral when it came to answering the question to regulate or not to regulate, I was never dead set against it on principle.
Hmm.
We did not see eye to eye in a couple of circumstances, one of which really came to a head towards the end, I think. Well, I can't remember whether it was in 84 or 85, but you might recall that there was a brouhaha, a scandal about the primary dealers. It was right on the heels of the savings and loan scandal.
Oh, yeah.
And then right on the heels of savings and loan scandals, there were some inappropriate behavior in the primary dealer market.
Uh-huh.
And as is the Congress's want and others, the cry went up to we should investigate this area and regulate these primary dealers, because they were unregulated,
mm-hmm.
Unlike the broker-dealer community and others and the mutual fund industry. Primary dealers were not regulated. Congress demanded that we conduct an investigation of the problem in the area and make recommendations. And I was very interested in this and followed our staff of the investigation or the survey. Actually, it was an investigation and a study. A study is probably the most appropriate way to call it, to describe it. Study was performed by the lawyers in our market regulation division. And it was market regulation was a considerable interest to me, as well as accounting issues. So I followed their progress and tried to stay abreast on what their findings were and what they thought that their conclusions and recommendations to the commission were going to be as they went on. So I felt fairly well versed in the factual underpinnings for the staff's recommendations eventually. Eventually the staff completed its study and at a public meeting proposed to the commission that we recommend the adoption of legislation that would require the primary dealers to limited regulation just in the shape of registering with the SEC so that their books and records were open to inspection and being subject to the SEC's anti-fraud powers. Very minimal, I mean, compared to what stock exchanges and broker-dealers have to submit the regulation to which broker-dealers are submitted. I can't remember whether they recommended capital requirements or not. My memory, you maybe might look at that. My memory is, doesn't serve me right. They may have recommended the capital requirements, but I cannot recall that.
Something that came out of the savings and loan issue was the matter of thrift conversions.
Yeah, that was a different issue, though.
Yeah, okay.
For the primary dealer. Because the primary dealers, of course, you know, are those dealers who deal in government bonds and treasuries and that sort of thing. They're placing government securities with investors. I don't think that the conversion issue was part of the issue. It was really, should we make them register and should we make them subject to the SEC scrutiny at least to the point that they have to register and subject to the SEC's anti-fraud powers.
Did Shad have the majority of the commission?
John Shad, Chairman Shad, was opposed to any regulation in this area at all.
Yeah.
And he and I were lobbying for votes on the issue. I was in favor of this limited incursion, and he was against it, and we spent a lot of time talking to our fellow commissioners trying to get each individual commissioner to see it our way. Ultimately, the vote was 4-1, I think. It was 4-1. Against proposing, recommending to Congress that that the primary dealers be subject to limited regulation. And I was the dissenting vote.
Yeah.
As it turned out, of course, my views were aligned with the staff. And I asked the chairman at the open meeting, I said, made a joke of it, which brought a big laugh even from John Shad. I said, Mr. Chairman, as you know, I'm dissenting. He said, yes. And I said, I would like your permission to file a minority report. Ha, ha, ha. And he smiled and said, sure. Like, minority report with Congress. And he said, oh, sure. Now, I'm sure, I don't know what John thought, but I think that he probably, the one thing I probably doubt that he would have thought was that my report would hit the Congress, the Dingell's desk and the congressman's desk before or at the same time the majority report was. But it did because all I had to do was to take Market Reg's report and recommendation and make it my own, which they were thrilled, of course, to have me do.
Sure.
While they turned to and prepared a report and recommendation reflecting the majority view. And as it turned out, I'm losing my recollection now. What was Dingell's committee named? I can't remember the House of Representatives, name of the House of Representatives committee that had jurisdiction over the SEC.
Right.
We can figure that out.
Yeah, that's a matter of public record.
Yeah, yeah.
But so Shad couldn't have been terribly pleased that you had a.
I had a report just as thick and well supported as the majority did before that congressional committee. At the same time, I think, you know, I don't know how long it was. It either got there a day before the majority report or right at the same time. And as a consequence, Dingell, who was chair of that committee, Markey was just thrilled with this, invited me to testify alongside John Shad on the issue. So I'm sure. But I'll tell you a story that says a lot about John Shad. He and I marched up to the Hill together and sat side by side and made our statements, one in favor of regulation, one against, answered the questions, et cetera, and toward the best of our ability, now, and went home that evening. But that evening, I had invited John Shad to a dinner party at my house. And it just turned out that it was the same evening that we were both up at the, on the Hill testifying. And he came. I'm a pretty good cook. He came, and we had a nice time. And I remember John Shad was there, and Ted Olson was there.
So he hadn't had enough for one day.
We had a wonderful evening. And I think that says a lot about his graciousness. Mm-hmm. He probably still was sticking a voodoo doll full of pins that evening.
Uh-huh.
As the upshot of the story is, of course, that that Congress did pass legislation requiring the primary dealers to register with the SEC and making them subject to the SEC's oversight. Anti-fraud oversight.
Well, that's quite a trick for a minority report.
How about that?
Well, something that I would think must have been a matter of great discussion would have been the rise of hostile tender offers.
Very much so. It was of discussion and of concern. However, as I recall, both at the commission level and at the staff, the staff directors and deputy directors and assistant directors, there was really a free market attitude, both in market reg and in Corp Fin, and a great deal of reluctance. As I recall, to interfere with the market process. And while for me personally it was a concern because it just seemed to me that the hostile tender offers that were going on at that point in time weren't adding value, really, to the economy or the market. They were just churning ownership of shares.
Right.
I came to understand with the real tutelage. I learned a lot from people like Ed Green was gone. Linda Quinn and Richard Ketchum and others who. Who really had a belief in and didn't want to muck about with the free market system. And I came to agree with that. I never agreed that hostile tender offers were good. because I think for me it's phony money, you know?
Right. But that does go counter to the sort of impression of regulators just looking for something to regulate.
Yes. Oh well, that was not this commission.
Yeah.
We're going to regulate for the sake of regulation.
Right.
They really thought, well, as long as people are fully disclosing what they're about,
mm-hmm.
and fully and completely disclosing what their plans and their attitudes are for this company, and why they're trying to take it over and why they're ginning up a takeover premium and that sort of thing, then we need to leave it alone.
Uh-huh.
And at the federal level, at least when I was at the SEC, the philosophy was we will require disclosure and we will punish fraud.
But there was a lot going on at the state level.
Very much so, but that was the state level. That was really one thing I learned, that the state level, there was a lot of substantive regulation going on, meaning we're going to make things work the way we think they should work or ought to work,
right?
And preclude activities that we think are inimical to the health and welfare of the shareholder or the corporation or other constituent communities, like communities that shelter the factories of these companies and the employees. You know, really, when you start talking free market and what you need to do to enhance the economy and make sure that our capital markets are functioning very well, at this philosophical letter, there's very little discussion or focus in the securities laws on guaranteeing jobs
right.
to employees.
Right.
It's all about return to the investor.
Sure.
So I learned a lot in those 4 years.
Well, something that happened during those 4 years, you were there for maybe the one of the glamour incidents in the life of the SEC, and that was the Boesky case.
Oh, yes.
And I understand that you even signed the papers authorizing charges against Dennis Levine. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about that experience.
Well, to there's nothing to tell other than it was one of the things that John Shadd was really devoted to stamping out insider trading. And as much as he did not want to muck about with the business of running capital markets and regulate the operations of the businesses in the capital markets, he was just as passionate about stamping out insider trading, because that, in his view, and rightfully so, he viewed it this way, is that undermined the integrity of the market and confidence in the market.
Uh-huh.
And so he made it a platform issue for himself to stamp out insider trading, and Boesky got an icon, and others got caught up in that. When we started enforcing Rule 13A, you know, we went after them for insider trading and violation of the disclosure rules of when you were operating as a group,
mm-hmm.
designed with takeover designs. We worked long and hard in investigating the facts against Boesky, and I was traveling at the time, but being a trial lawyer also made me particularly interested in litigation matters, and I followed the development of these cases as well very, very closely. And I was the officer of the day. You know, you never knew when the staff was going to get their case in shape and ready to be filed, and it could be at any time of the day or night, over the weekend, what have you. So for that reason, we always had a commissioner on duty
mm-hmm.
to sign off on complaints, because the commissioner had to sign a complaint or authorize
right.
the filing of the complaint
right.
or the issuing of a formal order or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, well, I don't know if it was Levine or if it was, who was it that was tracking me down? I was someplace and they wanted to call me and said, when are you going to be home? We've got the Boesky complaint all signed, sealed, and we need you to sign the formal order. For some reason, I had, you said Levine.
Dennis Levine. The Boesky case started with Dennis Levine,
right,
and,
right.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think who made that phone call to me and brought the complaint out to my house.
Would that have been Gary Lynch?
That was Gary Lynch,
yeah.
Right.
He was enforcement at the time.
Yes, yeah. It was Gary Lynch. Called and said, are you home? I said, I'm home. He said, we got it done. I said, great. He said, can I come? I came right over, and I signed the first complaint that was going to be filed against these no good people.
And
it was Gary.
Yeah. One of the interesting things, of course, is that one thing led to another, and enforcement made this deal with Boesky, and then the publicity got out about, you know, essentially that Boesky was running around doing business wearing a wire for X number of months. And I understand that the commission got a little bit of bad press because of that.
Yeah, it was always difficult, any activity like that when I was there was undertaken with much trepidation because everyone involved was very sensitive to the issue of the government employing subterfuge
yeah.
to bring people to justice. But in the end, I think we got comfortable with it.
Uh-huh. Something else that's big on the radar screen was the October 87 crash. Tell me
market break, we called it.
Okay. What were you doing when did you hear about it?
I was in the office when the market started to fall. And I'm not quite sure how it was brought. I mean, we knew that there was weakness in the market, and we also knew about the problems we were concerned about the problems that could be brought about by with this passive trading, program trading.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't recall who came into my office and said the market is falling and it's down 50 points and now it's down 100 points. But I do recall with that news, I went downstairs to Rick Ketchum's office. And they had monitors that would show you what was happening in the market.
He was Market Reg?
He was Market Reg, uh-huh. Richard Ketchum.
Yep.
One of the best of the brightest. And I remember sitting there talking to Rick and others on his staff and watching the screen wash red.
Yeah.
So it did look like a bloodbath. You know, it would wash red and then it would lighten up to yellow again and then it would wash red as these programs were being executed in the market dropped. I think, am I right in recalling it in that day or in half a day, the market fell 500 points.
Right, that's correct.
It fell 500 points, and I know that Rick was there, but he was running back and forth talking to, Shad was still chair at the time,
mm-hmm.
And Shad was talking to John Phelan, who is the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, and Rick was talking to Phelan and Phelan's deputies in their market regulation division, trying to figure out what we needed to do to prevent panic. and he was alternately on the phone with the SEC chairman, Phelan, the Fed, New York Fed, and Volcker, I guess, would have been head of the Fed at that point in time, about what our group reaction and response ought to be to this event. I don't want to call it a disaster, but it was pretty bad. And very worried about liquidity the next day, et cetera. So by the end of the day, and John Phelan, if you recall, kept the markets open, and the banks came in and assisted in liquidity. There was a lot going on in the scene behind the scenes that kept our economy from just imploding with that market drop. A lot of people putting their money and sell set at risk. So we ended out the day, and I remember discussions about what was going to happen the next day,
right.
And our concerns. I don't want to say too much here, but without doing research.
Sure.
I remember that while they were trying to stave off the apocalypse, or capital markets apocalypse, on that Monday, they were also thinking about how do we get it up and running and prevent the same thing happening. And so Market Reg, the lawyers in Market Reg were already thinking about the solution to the problem. And I think the commission acted pretty quickly in working out these market breaks, the trading stops, for 25-point drops in the market. We changed the rules of operation in the event of the market in order to prevent a 500-point drop in the future. But what I can't remember is how things went the following day. But I think the market improved. It never got below 500 points below. I think it started at 25 and it dropped to 2,000. Am I right?
I don't remember the numbers. I know it started bad the next day and then it turned around.
It turned around
in the middle of the day for some reason, which I'm not sure about.
Just not to execute the program trades.
This kind of the fallout from this fell to David Reuter's commission.
Yes, David Reuter, sir. He was chair for 4 years while I was for 3 years. But anyway, I served under him for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
I stayed for 4 years of my 5-year term.
Can you compare him a little bit with John Shadd? What was the change at the top like?
Well, I would rather not go into the SEC Historical Society archives comparing it to
okay.
But I'm happy to talk about David Reuter. You know, David, of course, is a Republican, too, but David is a very practical person and someone who is very much focused on making things work right, and for me the thing about David that I responded to was that he wasn't ideological in his approach to market regulation. It was, if there's a problem, will regulation fix it? And if it will, let's do it. And if there's not a problem, if there's a problem and we need to address it in some other way, we'll do it the other way. We won't regulate. He was very practical-minded and analytical in his approach to solving the problems that we that we faced at the commission. I'm trying to think, what was the big chunk of legislation that we voted on in July? I stayed to vote on it?
Well,
was that the market break stuff? I can't remember.
There were a couple
of big pieces of legislation that he and I were on the same side of.
Well, one was part of the fallout from the 87 market break, which was who's going to get to regulate the stock index futures, the derivatives. And there was the going back and forth between the SEC and the CFTC.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
The SHAD protocol that was hamstringing us.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Tell me about that discussion.
I don't remember enough of it in detail. I'll have to think about it.
Okay.
I remember that we thought it was imperative to change for the SEC to regulate derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
And if I recall correctly, we still had to sort of negotiate our way out from under a deal that John Shadd had cut with the CFTC on futures. So I think we left futures to them and took derivatives?
Took options.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that you lined up with him.
I lined up with David. I thought that he had a very sensible, practical approach, and it made sense.
At one point, you, I'm not sure what the source was, but you were reflecting on some of your accomplishments, and you felt that getting the SEC the power to bar repeat offenders from boards was something you were proud of doing.
It was more than that, actually,
mm-hmm.
but that was part of it. I began to believe that the SEC did not have enough power, powerful tools to correct and sanction some of the wrongdoing that we encountered, and that suspending people and letting them resurface 8 months later or 2 years later was not the right thing for the capital markets in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And I made several speeches on this, and ultimately worked with the staff helped me prepare some legislation. It didn't get enacted until, I think, the year after I left. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure it wasn't. '89 or '90 when Congress finally added to what I called the SEC's arsenal of weapons. The big controversy, what I was arguing for, was fines,
mm-hmm.
that we should be able to fine administratively and seek fines judicially, and that we should be able to bar people who had proven total lack of respect and regard for the securities laws for life.
Mm-hmm.
It was controversial because as I think of the arguments that were presented to me by former SEC attorneys and people in private practice, that said that the SEC had no power or authority to punish, and that fines were punitive.
Hmm.
Punitive, and I said, so we go to Congress and get the power. And so much for that. And there was also the sense that it was beyond the pale to bar someone for life from either serving as a corporate officer or serving working in the securities industry.
Hmm.
But I was not persuaded by those arguments, because after 4 years of seeing people who were historically securities laws violators. And we all know that there are people out there that are going to cross the line as often as they think it's necessary to either line their own pockets or to succeed in their endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
That they the law is not does not restrain them. And I thought that that if you've three, four times have egregiously violated the law, then they that you should be subject to a bar.
Sort of a three strikes and you're out.
Yeah, but not three strikes for stealing a loaf of bread.
Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't my point of view. So it wouldn't be three strikes for failing for a books and records violation.
Right.
Okay.
Sure.
So
sure.
Say you're head of a broker dealer and you have three or four or five or six books and records violations, and they're not. They're not threatening to the investing public, and they're not threatening to the integrity of the market. I wouldn't say, "All right, you're out, and you can't own a broker dealer."
Right.
But if you had over a period of 5 to 10 years or 5 to 7 years organized. A half a dozen reggae offerings in which people were defrauded, or in which your disclosures were inadequate or more than inadequate, false and misleading. Yes, I say you're out.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that was my approach to the solution to the situation, and ultimately. Congress did adopt that legislation. Of course, then I went back into private practice and had to deal with it.
Watch out what you wish for, huh?
Well, exactly. But exactly, I thought there were some people at the SEC that were just delighted in reminding me the things that I said as a commissioner that would come back to haunt me as a practitioner. But that underscores, I think, what made my experience so wonderful for me is that I had my commissioner's hat on for the whole 4 years that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I did try to do, as a commissioner, what was best in my mind at the time, based on what I knew, what was best for the investor, for the investing public, for the integrity of the markets, and not, gee, I'm here now, how can I rig this game so it'll be easier for me, or better for me, or make me look good to my former clients.
Yeah.
When I return. And trust me, some of my accounting firm clients would call me and say, "What are you doing?" I argued for open enforcement proceedings against accountants, and they'd always been private.
Mm.
I thought, you know, let's let a little sunshine in.
Uh-huh.
Here. Well, they didn't not hire me when I came back out to private practice because I took a position that they didn't like and that was very unpopular in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I think that I probably gained more of their respect.
Hmm. Why the decision to go back into private practice?
Oh, why not? I mean, it was time.
Yeah.
It was just time to do it. I loved the 4 years that I spent at the SEC, and I enjoyed living in Washington and enjoying all that entails, but after 4 years, I wasn't going to do it for the rest of my life, and I didn't have any political ambitions or ambitions to do something else in government. It was time to go back into private practice. Plus, my husband had come back to California to rejoin his medical practice. He had to after 3 years. He was there with me for 3 years, and I wasn't quite ready to leave, but so we commuted back and forth for a while for that last year, and that got old really fast. So that was sort of a logical, normal step for me to go back into private practice.
So it was back to Gibson Dunn.
I didn't even talk to any other firms. You could ask, I don't know why I didn't do that, but I went right back to Gibson Dunn.
And did you take up where you left off with
the
certification?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I think that the answer to that is yes and no. I did have, was able to attract business and mostly in the accounting area. The re-entry process was much more difficult than I thought it would be. I had been away for 4 years, not 1.5 or 2 years.
Right.
And so I found that I had to, at least I thought, I don't know if my perceptions are as accurate as they might be, but I thought that I had to prove myself again as a trial lawyer. Mainly probably because I hadn't done it for 4 years.
Right.
So I suppose that's not too unusual. But it was. I have to say I didn't think that my reentry was seamless. There was some catching up to do, some re-persuading to do for clients and partners. And it's never easy as a trial lawyer. You know, you don't have kind of ongoing clientele. People come to you with their problems.
Uh-huh.
And being out of that loop of being there as the problem solver, or not being there as one of the resident problem solvers for 4 years, I think made it a little more difficult to get back into the swing of things.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, and reestablished my practice and started trying cases again, and then it was time to retire.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I don't want to quit without talking a little bit about another part of your career that intersected a bit with the securities industry and the SEC, and that was your role on the Public Oversight Board.
Ah. Yes, controversy follows her.
How long had you been on the board?
I retired. I knew Mel Laird. I met Mel Laird when I was a member of the SEC,
mm-hmm.
and Mel Laird actually was the first person to bring me on to a corporate board.
Okay.
He and I hit it off, and I liked him, and he liked me, and he introduced me to the folks at American Express, which was mutual funds, which was then IBS Mutual Funds.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on that board. So I served with him for about 6 years, 7 years or so, and he was a member of the POB. The original POD.
Mm-hmm.
He contacted me one day. I don't know if why we were together, if he called me or we happened to be in the same place or on the same panel or something at the same time. And he suggested that he was ready to step down from the POB and that he would like to nominate me as his replacement. And at the same time, my husband was urging me to retire. My husband had been retired for several years, 4 or 5 years,
uh-huh.
Wanted to take long, exotic trips, and you can't do that married to a trial lawyer.
Sure.
Your life is not your own when you're trying cases or litigating.
Yeah.
And so he was urging me to retire, and Mel was saying, gee, this would be great, another public service job for you, POB, and it's right up your alley because of my knowledge of accounting and auditing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more knowledgeable about auditing than accounting. I worked towards retirement. I retired from Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher at the end of 2000, and concurrently with that, I was nominated to and elected to the Public Oversight Board.
Okay. So you were there for 2 years.
Well, a little less than that.
A little less.
Because that would have been December 2000. So I was there from December 31st or January 1st, 2001, through April 2002. So about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
by the time the POB actually closed its doors and wrote its final report.
Mm-hmm. And from your perspective, is the direction that oversight of the accounting industry went, is it looking like that ultimately is going to be a good thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because certainly
I don't
at the time,
that it necessarily had to go quite as far as it went.
Yeah.
I think the members of the POB, when we prepared our white paper that we submitted to the Sarbanes Committee.
Uh-huh.
As you know, the PCOB is modeled after a white paper that was prepared by the POB itself.
Ah, okay.
That, I don't know that, say, for I personally did not necessarily envision a full-time five-person board. I envisioned a five-person board working many more hours on the issue than the POB did,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't necessarily think that you had to have, you know, full-time POB members.
Right.
I did think that something that you did need a government-run inspection program as opposed to peer review.
Right.
I found that peer review, as a result of my work on the POB, to be ineffective in forcing and fostering changes where quality control systems where changes were obviously needed and necessary.
Right.
But I do think that in the long run, that this is the right, it's going in the right direction. My strongest held belief as a result of my experience on the POB was that the regulator of the accounting profession had to have a statutory base, as opposed to being the appendage of a trade organization.
Right.
And that it wasn't going to have the clout and the authority that it needed to have without having its authority and its power being based in statute and by an act of Congress.
Okay.
And I wrote that part of the white paper that said that, and I testified to that effect in Sarbanes.
Yeah.
I thought that was very important. And it had to have the means to fund its activities.
Right.
And they have that. So, and they have, and it needed a private investigation system. And for the rest of it, I think that it's okay. I'm not so, you know, I wasn't wedded to standard setting the way the PCOB operates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the proof will be in the pudding.
Right. That's interesting. You had the perspective on the POB to know what worked and didn't work, and turn it into something that hopefully will work.
I hope so. I think that there are good people serving on the PCOB, and I think that they're off to a good start. And from what I hear from the people that I know in the profession, for example, about the inspection programs that they have, is that they are tougher than reviews that were conducted under the rubric of peer reviews,
uh-huh.
but they believe that they'll be better off for it.
Yeah.
And that's what I believed in 2002.
Yeah.
When Chuck Bowser and I and the other members of the POB decided to disband.
Yeah.
Because that was in reaction to what I thought was overreaching on the part of the profession.
Right.
And others.
A dramatic gesture, perhaps, but maybe appropriate.
I'm sorry?
A dramatic gesture, perhaps, but
yes,
maybe appropriate.
Yes, it was, and we caught a lot of flack and criticism for it. Some people applauded it and patted us on the back, but it seems to me more often than not, we were saying, you should have stuck with it, you should have done this, you shouldn't have walked away. But you do what you have to do.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about these things today. I wonder if there's anything else that we haven't touched on that you think we should.
Well, we kind of, you're very good at taking people down memory lane. I'm sorry that my recollection was not as sharp and as quick as it had been. There probably are things that, given a little time, I would think about, I should, while you've tickled my memory, write them down, because I can always do another oral history. But they've been asking me, Carla Rosati has been asking me to organize myself to do an oral history now for about 5 years, and I haven't done it yet.
Well, now you have.
And so, exactly, now I have. The only other thing about my career in terms of SEC-related career that I would note as a real high point, I have to say how incredibly honored and privileged and touched I was when the Association of SEC Alumni nominated me and gave me the William O. Douglas Award several years ago for outstanding contributions to the development of securities laws and to the SEC community and the financial community. That is an acknowledgement that I treasure, actually, really treasure, and I can't think of any higher regard or accolade that I've have earned to date, or that I could earn in the future, than that I will treasure more than that particular award and acknowledgement.
Well, that's saying a lot, and it's saying a lot about the institution, of course.
It definitely is. It most definitely is. It was a wonderful, wonderful 4 years, and I made many, many wonderful friends and had an opportunity to work with truly outstanding people.
Well, it's been a great interview. Outstanding as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.